One could approach it as a religious historian. One could approach it as a political scientist. So you could talk about it either from the viewpoint of the history of religion. You could talk about the interaction between this faith and politics and history. And the two of you being art historians come at it from yet another perspective. And I wonder how it is you think perhaps that your take on it, your way of looking at it and answering the basic questions might be different from somebody who was from one of these other disciplines, a political scientist or an historian of religion.
Well, I think one way is that political historians, religious historians, rely on the written record alone. And art historians have the advantage of being able to rely on works of art as well. And often the people who made works of art didn't make written records. And so it gives us a window into perhaps a larger segment of society than just the people who wrote about it.
Hmm. Anything you, Professor Blair, you'd want to add to that?
I think that's very true, and I think it's a way that it makes it easier for people who are looking from the outside back or in and back to appreciate something that's quite remote from us today, certainly living in America, thousands of miles from where this religion took root.
Mm-hmm. When you look at Islamic art, and of course, here we're talking about a broad range of items and styles because there are many Muslims in many different places and the faith intersected with different cultures. But I suppose one has a sense of what Islamic decorative art and architecture is about. And maybe the main thing that people think of if they know anything is the idea that there was a disinclination to picture living creatures. Although you do see Islamic art that has people and animals in it,
right?
But it is highly figurative. A great deal of use of Arabic script as a decorative motif, and of course, very very sort of complex and beautiful geometric designs. Other design motifs that do come from nature.
Right.
But, you know, having said all of that, as one looks at the art and architecture, decorative arts that came out of, that really came out of Islam, what does that tell you about the faith? Does it tell you some things about that?
Well, I think the first thing to realize is that to compare it, let's say, with the art of the Christian world, that a great deal of the art that we think of as art, I mean, whether paintings or are all inspired by the religion directly, and images of Christ or images of the Virgin Mary or something. And there's none of that in Islam, because Muslims felt that and feel that there is absolutely no way that anyone could represent God. God is unrepresentable, but the only sort of representation that's possible for God is the written word, and that is the Quran, which was God's word revealed to the Prophet Muhammad. And so this has led to the preeminence of the written word in all forms of Islamic art. And you find not only manuscripts of the Quran, but also objects and buildings that are decorated with inscriptions. And writing, and the art of writing, has played an enormous role over the centuries.
Well, I think one of the things that you point out in the book is that many people believe that there was this proscription on showing human beings, showing living things from the very beginning. And you say that, in fact, that's not the case. How is it that came to be institutionalized?
Go ahead, John.
Oh, sure. I was going to give you, let you. Well, it that because there was no no official ban at the beginning, but because you couldn't represent God, and you certainly didn't want to represent the Prophet Muhammad because he was not a divine figure like Christ. He wasn't the son of God, but just a prophet. People chose to represent, had to come up with another way of decorating their buildings. And at first, I mean, in the areas where Islam developed in the Near East, they used the traditions of Christian art, but they sort of took out the figures and used the backgrounds. Remember, many of the people who were doing the decorating were Christians or Jews or new converts from those religions to Islam, and so they brought with them their traditions. And so what had been the background in earlier art, that is, the gold and the designs and the leaves and the flowers and the trees, became the subject matter. Mm. And Muslims saw that as representing all sorts of possible things. I mean, I don't think that everybody would agree, but some people saw it perhaps as representing the greenery of paradise, and other people saw it as representing the unity and diversity of God.
I think it's interesting when you might think from the point of view of an artist that this would be a limitation. That is, that there were certain things that you could not show, and yet at the same time they don't seem to have been limited. And what this did was, by perhaps putting a constraint in one sort of area, it led to great creativity in another, in doing what it taking to the very sort of to the limit what it was that you could do.
Right. Well, certainly. And I think, I mean, we don't have, for example, all the art that decorated palaces and private homes, from archaeology that there are some palaces that were decorated with figures and painting and stuff. But we don't have many examples of that, so we don't really know what those were like. We do know that in mosques, geometry and arabesque, this kind of vegetal plant ornament, was very popular, and inscriptions. And people took the art of writing to extraordinarily great levels.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an interesting something that you point out, that as you say, the original language of the sacred scripture of Islam, the Quran, is Arabic, and that people believed that to get it in its fullness, you needed to read it in the original language. And so that means that people who were coming to Islam, as best they could, would have to learn Arabic so that they could read the Quran. And so then you had a common language which could be used so people from a wide variety of places and backgrounds could communicate, and that then made it possible for a great exchange of information. And perhaps that was a thing that certainly facilitated a flowering of Islamic art, culture, science, that would perhaps not have been possible if all these people were not able to work in the same language.
Sheila, why don't you?
Absolutely, and even today, Muslims are expected to learn Arabic to read the Quran.
Well, do you think that the kinds of developments of, say, science and mathematics and philosophy that we know we owe to Islam would have happened if this common bond of language hadn't been there?
No, absolutely not. That it provided a kind of lingua franca. I mean, it was the works from all different languages, the knowledge of ancient Greece, the knowledge of ancient Central Asia, of ancient India, were all translated into Arabic. And scholars from all over the world, all over Eurasia whose native tongues might have been anything from Berber to Sogdian to Persian or whatever, all learned to speak Arabic and were able to communicate and share in Arabic. And indeed in Spain, in medieval Spain, that Christians came to learn Arabic or learned Arabic in order to get access to all this learning that was preserved in that language and translated into Latin.
Perhaps I should introduce again the guests for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Jonathan Bloom and Sheila Blair. They are the Norma Jean Calderwood Professors of Islamic and Asian Art at Boston College. They are a husband and wife team of historians and authorities on Islamic culture and are the co-authors of the book Islam, A Thousand Years of Faith and Power. TV Books is the publisher of this book. It accompanied a documentary series, Islam, Empire of Faith, which ran on many PBS TV stations around
the country. It's going to run.
Has not run.
It's going to run in May.
In that case, then, hopefully people will get the opportunity to see it. I apologize. I was a little confused about the scheduling of the program. And so people can look for it on PBS stations near them. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, just how much do we know for sure about Muhammad?
Go ahead, Jonathan.
Well, we know about him through the reports of his contemporaries. We don't have any letters. We don't have any pictures of Muhammad. But he was such a revered figure that his contemporaries preserved virtually every act and deed and told these events, told stories about them to other people. And within about a century of his death, people had started collecting these deeds and acts and sayings of the Prophet. And they came to supplement the Quran as a kind of basis on which a good Muslim should lead his life. And these are known as the traditions. They cover every subject from, washing and personal hygiene to, how you treat your children or your parents.
So the whole business of the basic requirements of Islam are relatively simple and straightforward. There are the things like the requirements to pray at the prescribed times, to make the pilgrimage to Mecca if you can, to give alms to the poor, to up front to acknowledge there's no God but God, and Muhammad is his messenger, those sorts of things. But then there's another sort of a list of things that are the requirements of being a good Muslim, and there it's the life of Muhammad that tends to be the model. He is the ideal Muslim that people are supposed to try and pattern themselves after.
Right, and to emulate.
Hmm. He a relatively short period of time after his founding the faith, he died. It was only, I think, about 10 years, right?
Yeah, well, it's 10 years after he moved. He began to receive revelations in the early seventh century, and in 622, he was forced to leave Mecca, where he had lived, and move with a band of believers, other believers, to the nearby town of Medina, and that's in 622, and that's the Hijra. And that's the date when Muslims believe that, sort of, if there's a date for the founding of Islam, this is the time when a group of people get together and give up the bonds of a community based on lineage and family, and go into one that is based on faith and all following the same faith. And then 10 years after that time, in 632, Muhammad dies.
And that did create some difficulties, and perhaps the echoes are still felt around the issue of succession.
Well, absolutely. Muhammad had many children, all of whom died in infancy, except for a daughter. And the question was how he should be succeeded. And some people believed that the most able member of the community should be elected to succeed him. And some people felt that he should be succeeded by members of his family through the descent from this one daughter. Those who felt that it should be by election eventually came to be known as the Sunnis, and those who felt that it should be a member of the family came to be known as the Shiites. Mm-hmm.
Was there, do you think, something about Islam that made it particularly appealing to people or that aided in its rather rapid expansion?
Sheila?
Sure. Islam is a wonderfully simple religion in which there is no intercessor between the believer and God. There's no church, there's no hierarchy, and people were immediately attracted to this, particularly because at that time both the Sasanians and the Byzantine Christians had evolved an extraordinarily complex religion in which God was virtually hidden from the common person. So Islam offered immediate and direct access to God.
What would have been the predominant, for people who were converting to Islam, what would it been likely that they would have been converting from?
Well, it depended on where you were. In the Mediterranean world, all around the shores of the Mediterranean, which had been the Roman Empire and then became the Byzantine Empire, many people, if not most people, were Christians, had adopted Christianity. It had become the state religion by the 4th century. But in Arabia, there were a large number, there were Christians. There were also large numbers of Jews. There were in Iran, most of the people were Zoroastrians, were followers of Zoroaster, and Zoroastrianism was the state religion in Iran. In Central Asia, there were Buddhists, Islam considered both Christianity and Judaism as earlier revelations that were guided by Scripture, and so Jews and Christians were known as the people of the book and were accorded a much higher status in society than were pagans, for example.
One of the fascinating branches of Islam is its mystical branch, is Sufism, the Sufis, who were responsible for, I think, a major phase of the expansion of Islam. They were really responsible for the spread of the faith to India, to Central Asia, to Sub-Saharan Africa. And I know that within Islam there may be some controversy about whether this is whether it's truly Islam or whether it's something. Well, I guess they would say that they weren't Muslims, but that whether or not it's the right path for people to be following or not. What constitutes the essence of Sufism?
Go ahead, John.
Well, I think the essential is this notion that one can experience God directly without relying on the sort of the forms and legalities prescribed by any religious authority. so that I think the Sufi, or the person who accepts this mystical view of Islam, tries to recreate the ecstatic experience of Muhammad when he received the word of God directly. And Sufis over the centuries have come up with different ways of doing this, of achieving this ecstatic experience. And some believe that you can repeat the sacred names of God over and over again and sort of go into a trance. And other people believe that you should do it by dancing and whirling, and so you or music or chanting. They're all different ways.
We're just about the midpoint of this first hour of Focus 580. Perhaps again, I just mentioned that our guests, Jonathan Bloom and Sheila Blair, are professors of Islamic and Asian art at Boston College. They're the co-authors of Islamic Arts and the Art and Architecture of Islam, 1250 to 1800, as well as authors of many other books and articles dealing with Islamic art and civilization. They have taught both in the United States and abroad, and are the authors of this book that I've mentioned, Islam, A Thousand Years of Faith and Power, published by TV Books, which is intended as an accompaniment to a documentary series, Islam, Empire, Faith, which will be airing next year in May. On a good many public television stations around the country. So if you're interested, certainly you should look for that program. And, of course, questions are welcome here on the show. All we ask of callers is we just try to ask people to be brief, just so it's possible for us to accommodate as many different people as possible and kind of keep things moving along. But, of course, anybody's welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Let's talk first with, we'll go to someone here locally on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm wondering if the guests know anything about current trends in contemporary Islam. They could talk about something there, because I have a question if they can.
I don't know. The book is kind of restricted to this first 1,000 years, but I won't speak for the guests. They can decide whether they would like to try to respond or not. Why don't you go ahead and ask your question, and then we'll have them take their best shot.
Well, I was visiting a Quranic school in Lisbon, Portugal, a couple years ago, and afterwards, we were visiting with a number of the al-hajjas that were in this particular school, and there were a number of people in one room that were watching a videotape of a four-year-old child expounding on the Quran. And apparently, this was considered a miracle by the people who were watching this video, which was very popular. He was, in fact, the son of, I think, Christian parents, had no formal religious training, and then yet one day began to spout, according to the story, literally the Quran just from scratch, and after a certain point began to expound on sort of legal niceties and so forth. And in this video, he'd filled a stadium. He was this little kid, dressed very formally, just doing his thing. And I was wondering if they knew anything about this child, because I'm very curious about this particular phenomenon, or if this is something that is perhaps common in the history of Islam, these sorts of people who rise up. If they could just answer to that, and I'll just hang up and listen.
All right. Thank you. I don't know. Is that something that you're familiar with or could say something about?
Sheila?
Well, there's been a long tradition. The Prophet himself is said by many to have been ummi, illiterate, and suddenly have received this revelation, so that there's this great tradition of instant knowledge and becoming an instant sayer, an instant speaker. I can't speak to this particular example, but all cultures and religions have their miracles.
And, of course, the great miracle in Islam is the revelation of the Quran to the Prophet, which is entirely unlike the miracle in Christianity, which is that God brought down his son.
Well, that's perhaps the best answer in this format on this show that we can give to the caller. Let's go to, we have somebody on a cell phone here calling from our local area, line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have three questions. I'm a Muslim, but I have three questions. So I will tell them and I will hang up and listen, because I'm in my car, okay?
Right. Yes.
Number one, why should, if there is one God, why should people have to learn Arabic in order to communicate with their God? That's one question. Number two, what do you have to say about the life of Muhammad as a prophet who married at age 25 to the one of the most powerful figure in Saudi Arabia at that time, Khadija, when she was 45 and he was 20-some. And after her death, he married Aisha, who was the daughter of the second most powerful man in that area, at age 6, and then the marriage consummated apparently at age 9. 9 months after the marriage to her, he asked by revelation, by bringing a verse from God, to ask his adopted son to divorce his wife so he can marry Zainab, his wife. And that is, by the way, only the only wife of Muhammad whose name has come in Quran. And then, you know, we have other wives. So what is the good thing about that? So I just want to know about, you know, what is the logic, the reasonable logic. Number three is this. We all know that all these things that is practiced by Muslim, from worshiping 5 times a day, what to eat, what not to eat, the circumcision, bunch of other things, have been taken from Judaism. So there wasn't much that Muhammad offered Muslims, okay? And the other thing is the beating of the wives, which is in the Nisa, the verses of Nisa, that if your wife doesn't listen to you, tell them, then deprive them of your bed, and then beat them. So what is the defense? I don't need a defense. What is the logical reasoning that one can accept to all these things that you are portraying an Islam of such a wonderful religion and all that? I am in conundrum, okay? Thank you, and I hung up and listened to you. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you for the call. Well, we'll have the guests do their best. I think we should say that I know that through your book and your association with this documentary, you're not being apologist for Islam, nor necessarily saying that everyone should be Muslim. Neither of you are Muslim,
not.
Are you?
Okay. We haven't converted.
Okay. So maybe let's try and make some response to the what the caller had to say. Starting with the first question, why should people have to learn Arabic really to come to God? Or in fact, I'm not sure that that's what really...
Right. Well, for Muslims, God spoke in Arabic. The Quran was revealed in Arabic. So if you are a Muslim and you believe, you must believe in it in Arabic. You can't read it in any other language.
Hmm. Now, it has been translated, though, into other languages.
It has been paraphrased, but for a Muslim, those are God's words. And God spoke to Muhammad in Arabic. So for them, and that's part of the sacredness of the language and why writing embellishes everything. So you can carry on your day-to-day conversations in any language you care to, but if you want to have a religious discussion about God and you want to read or speak the Quran, you must do it in Arabic.
Hmm. Any sort of comment that you would want to make on Muhammad's
marriage.
Life, on marriage and his...
I think it's unfair to judge societies of 1,400 years ago by our modern rules and regulations. In his time, Muhammad was actually quite something of a free thinker, in the sense that he was willing to marry widows, and traditionally widows were cast off as used goods. And so by marrying them, he actually accorded them a better position than they had before. Now, our views have changed, and we don't necessarily think that you should have as many wives as perhaps was possible or accepted 1,400 years ago.
Well, were these, at least the first two marriages, were they political marriages?
Well, he had worked for his first wife. He was her employee. She was a very successful and very rich widow, and he managed her caravans. And he did such a good job of it that she eventually married him as well.
Hmm.
Is that a political arrangement? Did they get to know each other better because they worked together? He clearly earned her respect and trust because he'd done such a good job.
What about the notion that that Muhammad might have taken some of the elements of Islam from existing faiths? Are there some things that
absolutely? I mean, he grew up in the lands where these faiths had grown up. For instance, the original direction of prayer was toward Jerusalem, and it seems as though Muhammad had hoped, or through Muhammad, it had been seen that Jews might convert to the new faith. When it was clear that not all Jews were going to do so, there was another revelation from God that the direction of prayer was changed, and now Muslims pray toward Mecca. But that's not to say that all things are the same as Judaism. Clearly, some things were taken over, but some things, like the Qibla or direction of prayer, were changed.
With the caller is calling back. I think she's somewhat unsatisfied with our discussion here, so maybe we'll give her the opportunity to do a follow-up here on line number one. Hello?
Yes. I'm sorry, my antenna was frozen, and I barely could hear, but I could not help hearing here that he married mostly the widows. This is unbelievable.
His second wife was not a widow. Excuse me, I said his first wife was a widow.
The third wife after that was the of his adopted son. Mm-hmm. He brought a verse from God that because he saw her naked in the bathroom, and in fact the wife told her husband that I think Muhammad saw me, and he goes, the son goes to Muhammad and says, do you want me to have her? She says, what are you talking about? No, but then he could not satisfy his urges and brought the verses that, oh yeah, and God says, for what good things he bring you, do not. Yes, he asked this adopted son to divorce. What are you talking about, the widows? I mean, this is the answers that we have to face, and this is the things that we have to deal with. You know, in this century, we cannot just close our eyes and brain to what has been said. And sorry, as a woman, I have lots of problems with this kind of behavior and conduct about someone who comes and, you know, claims to be sent by God and then practices. And you are saying that every Muslim should go ahead and live his life or her life as what Muhammad is prescribing.
Well, I think it's quite clear that Muhammad didn't say that everybody should that these are people after him who said that everybody should live his life following Muhammad's model.
But how can you justify his conduct of marrying at age 20 to most powerful, the richest woman in Saudi Arabia who had so much wealth? And then
I'm not trying to justify it. We're just telling the stories.
Well, I hope so. I hope.
I mean, we're trying to explain, I mean, a part of history. And I don't think that this is the most, I mean, clearly this is not the focus of our book and our interest. I mean, we're trying to talk about 1,400 years or 1,000 years of civilization that was inspired by the Prophet. And there's good and there's bad in it.
We just have about 10 minutes left. I do have another caller. I hope the previous caller will forgive me for wanting to move on. And maybe I'll just again introduce our guests. We're speaking with Jonathan Bloom and Sheila Blair. They're professors of Islamic and Asian art at Boston College and are the co-authors of the book Islam, 1,000 Years of Faith and Power, which is a concise history of roughly the first 1,000 years of Islam. Basic descriptions of practice and belief, but also history and looking at the impact of Islam on the development of the culture and the art of the Middle East, and also further, of course. The book is published by TV Books, and as I mentioned, it's intended to be a complement to a documentary series, Islam, Empire, Faith, which will be seen on many PBS stations next year. We have another caller here.
I'm here.
Okay, and we have some other folks here. We got somebody on our toll-free line. We'll go here to line number four. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to ask you about a bit of Muslim history that Yasser Arafat refers to when he talks about his relationship with the Jews. He says that his agreements with the Jews are like Muhammad's agreements a treaty with the, I believe it's the Quraysh tribe. It was a tribe of people with whom Muhammad made a treaty, a peace. And as soon as he became, because he was not strong enough at that time to conquer the Quraysh tribe, and so he made a treaty with them until he became strong enough. Then he broke the treaty and conquered them militarily, slaughtered a lot of them. Yasser Arafat uses that precedent, that Muhammad precedent, for the way that he is going to not respecting the agreements that he makes with the Israelis. Could you describe what that actual history was? And then, if I have time, I'd like to ask some more questions.
Well, can you make some response to the question of the caller?
Well, Muhammad was of the Quraysh. That was his tribe. So he couldn't have made a treaty with them. I don't think that this is, and I'm not sure. I don't know the incident either.
He did make treaties with several Jewish tribes. The treaties eventually were not honored on both sides, and he eventually went to war. It is true, against the Jewish tribes. We have wonderful, if we want to talk about culture, depictions from the 14th century of Muhammad's battles. Our 14th century, the Muslim 8th century, wonderful miniatures showing Muhammad taking on the Jewish tribes.
You also refer to the fact that Muhammad revoked the idea of praying toward Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
That is correct, is it not?
Mm-hmm.
When he found that the Jews were not going to convert.
Well, it's difficult to. I mean, we have to talk about this very carefully. That. If we say Muhammad revoked, then this offends Muslims who believe that the Quran is the word of God.
Uh-huh.
And so we say that, you know, that there was a revelation that, and which said in the year 2 after the Hijra, so 623, that Muslims should no longer face Jerusalem in their prayers, but instead turn towards Mecca and the Kaaba, the black structure in Mecca, to pray.
Yeah, but it raises a problem, because contemporary Muslim theology, or at least what they're saying, their revised history, is that Muhammad ascended to heaven from Jerusalem, and that doesn't follow that he would have ascended from Jerusalem if he had denounced Jerusalem. But it is also true that if you look at history, he was supposed to have ascended from Jerusalem from a mosque in Jerusalem, but history tells us there wasn't a mosque there until about 80 years after Muhammad's death.
No. I think you're trying to make a political statement about the primacy of Jerusalem for different religions. And it is clear from the beginning of Islam that from the very beginnings of Islam, that Jerusalem was an important city for Muslims. And that for your argument about a mosque, there's a famous saying of the Prophet Muhammad, all the world is a mosque. One can pray anywhere. So I don't think you should worry about the question of a particular mosque. And the verse, or you're referring to a Quranic verse, I think it's chapter 17, where it very briefly says the prophet went from the nearest mosque to the furthest mosque. And that furthest mosque is what we today know as, and for centuries people have understood as, El Masjid al-Aqsa, the Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem.
Hmm. We just have about 5 minutes left, and I have a couple of other people, and I hope the caller will forgive me because I wanted to try to get some more folks in. We'll go to Terre Haute next, line number one. Hello.
Yes. I have a question for anybody. Many years ago, I heard of a prophet or a Caliph Ali, who I believe in about 720, organized a group of religious people of different faiths in an effort to find some kind of brotherly love between religions. And he believed that men of all faiths should be able to live together peacefully. I had forgotten that story until just recently. I was talking to a young man from India who happens to be a Hindi, and he was telling me, yes, that as a child in school, he had learned the same story. In India, they call him Prophet Ali. Can any of you shed light on this individual? Thank you.
All right. Can you?
Sure.
No.
Can you?
No.
Ali is the son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad, but there are many people whose name, and that is the most famous Ali. But I can't, I don't know the story to which the caller refers.
So there's no way of knowing if this is the Ali in question.
Right. I mean, I think at many times and in many places, people have attempted to encompass other faiths and in a message of brotherly love. And indeed, I think a great deal of Islam was intended for that.
Well, that's probably about the best we can do. Let's go to Savoy for someone else here. This is line number two. Hello?
Yes. Hello?
Yes.
I'd like to respond to your two last callers, if I could, very
yes.
quickly.
Yes.
Especially the one just immediately before, the two callers ago,
uh-huh.
made the very terrible slander against Prophet Muhammad. He made some mention about Yasser Arafat and his treaties with the Israelis. I'm not calling to defend or say anything about Yasser Arafat, but this is a slander that's been repeated in a couple of different major media in the last couple of years, and in both cases, one case in particular I can recall is U.S. News and World Report. They then had to retract and publish a very fulsome apology when the facts were brought to their attention. And the treaty that he was referring to is the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. This was the treaty between Muhammad in Medina after he had been forced to flee from Mecca from the persecution of his own tribe, the Quraysh. He fled to Medina. The first Muslim community was established there in Medina. And they did have a treaty with the Quraysh. The fact is that the Quraysh broke the treaty. And after the Quraysh broke the treaty, then Muhammad declined to renew the treaty and went on to conquer the city of Mecca. When he came to the city of Mecca, in fact, he walked into the city of Mecca. His army was so large and powerful that he simply walked in. Everybody laid down their arms, and basically they were in fear that he was going to slaughter them. And in fact, he said, "How can I slaughter you guys? You're my family. You're free to go as long as you don't oppose me, as long as you don't oppose my religion." So as far as claiming that Muhammad broke any treaty, that is completely false. That is the opposite of what happened. There was a treaty. The treaty was broken, but it was not broken by Muhammad. It was broken by the other side. The last caller made some mention about something in India. I believe what he's referring to is not Ali. I think it was the Mughal Sultan. I believe his name was Akbar. He tried to establish a kind of secular ideology called Deen-e-Lahi, which means the faith of God, and which in effect was sort of the least common denominator of all the religions under his rule, to make that the kind of official ideology of his empire, of his kingdom or empire, sultanate, whatever it was called.
Right. This Akbar did this, and it lasted for his lifetime and
right.
barely that.
Right. Is the ideology he was talking about. This has nothing to do with Ali, who is the fourth caliph of Islam, but is somebody who came much, much later than what the previous caller was referring to. Thank
Good.
You.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. Thanks for that information. Let's try real quick here to do Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Quick question. Could one of your guests recommend a good English translation of the Quran? I suppose by good I mean reasonably complete and readable.
Well, the best one, most readable one is by Arbery, A.J. Arbery, and it's called The Quran Interpreted.
Arbery?
A-R-B-E-R-R-Y.
Okay.
And there's a very new book, which is very accessible, which is called Approaching the Quran, The Early Revelations, which is by Michael Sells, and it's probably the best.
L-S.
early introduction to it with a CD. It comes with a CD.
His name is
S-E-L-S.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Well, at that, we're going to have to stop because we have come to the end of our time. Obviously, a very complicated and rich topic that 50 minutes doesn't quite do justice to. So we would suggest people look for the documentary series Islam, Empire of Faith. It will be seen on many public TV stations around the country next year. And if you're interested, also, you can look at the book that we have talked about here. The title of the book, Islam, A Thousand Years of Faith and Power, by Jonathan Bloom and Sheila Blair. To you, Professor Bloom, Professor Blair, thank you very much for talking with us today.
It's been a pleasure.